All right, it is 6:32. We're going to call this meeting to order. We seem to have a quorum. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Esri, Michaels,
present.
Rodriguez, Sexton,
here.
Storr,
present.
Straub,
yes.
Locke,
here. All right, moving on. Can I get a motion for an approval of the agenda? Moved Sexton.
Second Straub.
Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
All right. Moving on. Looking for a motion for approval of the minutes. Anyone? Go once. Dr. Storr moved. Second, Mr. Sexton. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
No opposed. Moving on. Is there any public participation tonight? Only those we've invited. Close that out. Any communications from the board? Ms. Michaels.
Just real quick, I just got a note from Aaron. He's running a little bit late, but he will be here.
Great. Awesome. Any other communications while I try and pull mine up? Dr. Storr, you're good for time.
Yeah. I think we have a household hazardous waste collection coming up real soon, so you can still sign up for that.
Okay. I have just a brief blurb here. I spoke with Lynn Canfield about lots of stuff earlier today, and she directed me to report that I have not yet read, but it lists that one of the results of this report that Lynn pushed my way that I'll send out to the task force is that adults with substance abuse disorder who need but did not receive treatment, Illinois ranks dead last, lower than D.C., lower than Oklahoma, lower than West Virginia. So it's good we're here, and we're going to come up with ways to help with our money.
Can you read that title again, please?
Yes. One moment. I'll forward this to the task force as well. This is from the MHANational.org. It's a report for the state of mental health in America. And she said that the part that we might like is on page 22, adults with substance use disorder who need but did not receive treatment, we rank dead last. So I'll forward that out to everybody after the meeting tonight. Hello, welcome. Moving on, if there's no further communications, new business, we have a presentation from See You at Home. Feel free to come forward, and all we would ask that when you speak, make sure you turn on the microphone, and you'll see a little red light, and you'll know that you're good.
Good evening. Thank you so much for having us. I'm Melissa Courtright. I'm the executive director with See You at Home, and I have some people with me. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, I'm Tammy Lemke, and I am a consultant with See You at Home, though, working on the strategy to work in the sector.
Or maybe, do you want to come up to the...
No, sure. Cedar King, a meds program manager at See You at Home.
I'm Mike Royce, the board chair.
Welcome, one and all.
Thank you so much. So as we go through the presentation, just feel free to stop me at any point if you have questions, because I really want to make sure that you feel like you get the information that you need tonight. So, really informal, just shout out any questions that you might have.
Before you begin, sure. I just want to inform the task force that in the meetings, in the months that we haven't been meeting, Michelle Jett and I have been meeting with various agencies and stakeholders just to get a further education of where we are in the lay of the land. And in meeting with Judge Dyer, he was very clear that if it were up to him, and if the money couldn't go towards just medically assisted treatment, he really believes in the work that See You at Home is doing, and he feels that that can, the work they're doing positively affects people that have found themselves in the legal system due to opioid use. And so that is why we have See You at Home here tonight, and we're anxious to hear what you have to say. Thank you for letting me interrupt.
Oh, no, yeah. Thank you so much for bringing that up. Yeah, we're very grateful for our partnership with Drug Court, and we'll talk about that just a little bit in our presentation as well. All right, so just a little bit of a brief history of how our organization got to the point where we're running what we call a mid-barrier shelter program. A few years ago now, we were the low-barrier emergency shelter in Champaign County, and the city of Champaign Township is now Strides, who are the low-barrier emergency shelter provider in the county. When we learned that Strides was going to become operational, what that allowed us to do as an organization was really to take a look at what would be the gap in service. And so we began to really think about what we knew about the population we were currently serving. And one thing that became pretty clear was that there is a segment of the population that is not yet ready for change, and there is a segment of the population that is ready to make change. And so we saw this as an opportunity to form a mid-barrier program to address the needs of people who were ready to make change. So some of the things that we saw that felt very important in executing that program was intensive case management, the need for 24/7 support and stability, and the need for our services to be, again, kind of that intensive case management model where we're still staffed 24/7 and providing those intensive services to people that are really motivated and ready to move forward and make change. So our mid-barrier program currently is executed in two houses. One is a women's shelter and one is a men's shelter. Each of those homes holds 8 people. And so that is wonderful. We're grateful to be able to serve the 16 total people that we can serve in the mid-barrier shelter. But our constant issue and constant concern is our lack of capacity. So we have far more calls and needs for service than we have beds available. So the mid-barrier program is what we refer to as phases 1 through 3 of the program. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we progress here. So the other part of our program is the advanced shelter, or phase 4 of our program. And we have 5 homes in the community that we consider phase 4 or advanced shelter. So those houses are still case managed, but they're not staffed 24/7. So the goal of our program is to begin with really intensive services because that's what's needed as people enter into the program. But gradually over time, clients are able to obviously complete more tasks on their own. They have employment. They have been in recovery for some time at that point. And so it really is a progressive system. And as part of that system, people move into houses where, again, they're not staffed 24/7. So as part of the process, clients must complete an intake. They agree to participate in the program. They must demonstrate that they're consistently working toward goals. We don't ask that they perfectly work toward their goals, partly because that's not anything I could say every day. But the whole idea is that they're consistently working toward their goals. And part of that consistency demonstrates not just a change in behavior, but it indicates a change in mindset. It indicates that people really are moving toward the repairing and rewiring of the brain that happens after someone's been in addiction for a long time or been in trauma for a long time. So we really do look for that consistency in our clients and in our program. Each intake client case plan, although we do have a structure to our program, is very individualized. We recognize that each person that comes through our door has their own story, their own reasons, how they became addicted to substances, how they found themselves homeless. And so we really do try to develop individualized case plans with each person that comes into the program. So as part of the intake, we do screen people. We do ask about mental health services or mental health history, substance use, physical capabilities, criminal background. A person, obviously, with concerns in any of those areas, that doesn't mean they don't get into the program, but we need that information so that we can better serve them in our program. So we really do need as much of that complete history as possible. During the intake process, what we're really looking for, though, is a motivation for change and a willingness to participate in the program. So as I said before, in the mid-barrier program, the services are very intense. Each client is assigned to a case management team. That means they have a case manager and a care coordinator that is assigned to their case. In addition to that, we also have life skills staff that are present in the mid-barrier shelters 24/7. And so it's a lot of intensive supports and services. We do provide trauma-informed care. Again, as I said, our care plans are client-centered. And everything is the goal of moving our clients to stability. And that's stability in their recovery, financial stability, housing stability, physical health stability. We kind of want the whole package as much as possible so that when they integrate into the community, they really are ready to stay in the community long term. We've just found when we leave gaps and we're not addressing those pieces, if we're not addressing all the points of instability, people just cycle back in through the system. And so we really want to address all of the points of instability. Each phase is progressive and builds on each other. Each phase requires new skill and promotes stability. So, for example, our phase one requirements are fairly low-hanging fruit, and part of that is we just want them to acclimate to a safe environment. We want them to focus on their recovery. There are some times, for example, in those phase one and two, we encourage people to hold off even on employment just because the recovery requirements that we have are so intensive. We want them to focus on recovery. We recognize that if they don't do that and get employment too soon or try to move through the program too soon, that can be a trigger for relapse. And so we do ask that they go at a pace that really promotes and supports their recovery. So these are our focus points within each of our phases, and each of them, again, is points where people come in with some instability and insecurity, and we work toward promoting that stability and making sure they have the skills they need when they leave our program. So the recovery support, I wanted to really highlight that again because that's obviously the overlap here. So about three-fourths of our clients come into our program with substance abuse disorder. About a third of those, their primary drug of choice is opioids. And about a third of people out of that three-fourths, their secondary is opioids. So a lot of our clients come in with multi-use issues. So, for example, somebody's primary drug of choice may be cocaine, but oftentimes they have misused prescription medications. So we do see a lot of clients that fall into the category of opiate addictions and recovery. So we do sometimes require treatment. That's not required all the time, but if we assess a person and we determine that for a lot of different reasons, treatment is the safest and best option for them, we may require that before someone comes into the program. If they agree to go into treatment, we hold their bed. We don't want them to be penalized for making that choice, so we do hold the bed in that case. We do require that they complete an intensive outpatient program. They have to attend a certain number of recovery support group meetings. Those meetings are, the requirements are heavier, for example, in phase one. They have to attend 7 meetings, for example. Again, that's why, you know, we encourage people to focus on their recovery. And then over time, gradually those meetings can decrease, but it's always a requirement in all phases for them to attend some kind of recovery support group meetings. We do also require that they obtain a sponsor or some sort of recovery support that they can document, that they can indicate this is a person I can call, this is, you know, the steps that I'm working, or, you know, if they're not part of AA or NA, they're part of Celebrate Recovery, they may use different terms, but we want to see that they're progressing through some sort of system in the recovery space. They're also required to create a prevention relapse plan and to maintain sobriety. If somebody does not maintain sobriety, it does not mean that they are immediately exited from the program, because we do understand that relapse is part of recovery. And so in those instances, when someone does relapse, what we do is we look at their plan. You know, we may have to go back to square one, where we're back at, you've got to do treatment again. We may be back at intensive outpatient. We may be increasing their amount of support meetings, you know, so we're just really looking at all of those things. We have had times where we've had, you know, people that were in, say, phase four, an advanced shelter, and we've had times where we've had to take a step back just for their safety and support of their recovery. And so, you know, that's something that we do. So we have had a strong partnership with Drug Court. That partnership started actually, it predated our launch of the Mid-Barrier program, but it's really been strengthened through the course of that program. So we've housed 11 Drug Court clients to date. I think things that really work well with that model for us is that it is a wraparound model. Everybody is at the table brainstorming, figuring out, and that includes the client too, as how can we best help you? How can we best support you? Drug Court is a problem-solving model. We're also problem-solving all the time. So, again, we have a structure that we follow, but we are down in the weeds problem-solving all the time and trying to figure out how we can best support our clients. And I think the goal of their program, our program, again, is ultimately client stability. So the past couple of years, every year the News Gazette features a Drug Court client. In the past 2 years, those clients have also been CU at Home clients. And so we're really proud of our clients that have not only graduated from our program, but also graduated from Drug Court. And those requirements are not, they're not easy things to do. And so we're really, really proud of them. I'll let you.
Wonderful. Pardon my need. It's our... We really do know how to do this. One of the things that we were brought today, we were asked to talk about what the need is and what we think, how we can solve that need. As Melissa says, that we feel we are part of our case management program. Majority of the case management program is funded by the Mental Health Board. And so there is a commitment within the Mental Health Board. We are proud this year that we got a 2-year contract, which it's not easy to get sometimes, so very thrilled with that. It allows us, I mean, here again, Lynn and her team have been very side-by-side partnership, making sure that we can get to true outcomes for our clients, and so that's important. With that secured, what we realize, though, and as you realize, is that the need is larger than we can have. We have a waiting list of about 60 people to get into our 16 spots. Here, and you're going to ask me, the waiting list is hard to see, because if you're in need of housing today, you're probably not on the list tomorrow or the next. So I wanted to know that, but we keep the list. But in the last couple of months, we stopped doing that very purposefully, because you put people up for expectations that we're not able to walk through. And so we've been very clear with people who are calling that say, unfortunately, you know, the waiting list is long. We also are very clear that we're very happy that our partnerships was not only Drug Court, but with Rosecrans to refer into the programs, that they have a little higher level. And so those referrals are coming in faster than we can get to the other people on the other list as well. So the need, we need to expand. The simple as that. As you say, we currently hold 16 mid-barrier in 2 residential homes. Those homes, one is in Urbana, one is in Champaign, and I'm sure you've seen the one in Urbana's on Springfield Avenue. It still is a great home. It's gone really, really well. Both are sitting residentially. We're very excited that residential model is working for now, but what we've found is 2 things with that residential model, with individuals who are just coming in on level one, at mid-barrier one, is one, a home environment is very difficult to, we have 2 people in each room, So even though it feels like it's your own home, you're really still not. The home for the women is though it can hold 8 people, it has 4 bedrooms, it's an older home, they're both older homes, and so there is ease. It's not really made for level 1 or level 2 programming very much. Now, it's working, so we're very happy with it. And you know, if that's what we have, we're going to do the best we can. And it is working. As you know, we've already graduated people out of those programs, and they're doing really well. But we're committed to expanding to a location that can not only serve more people, but do it in a better trauma-informed way. And what that is the step-up process. We have, and I don't know, we can go back through. We have actually presented to the city of Urbana when they had the ARPA funding to give out of a model that we are presenting to you today as well, of a model that can include mid-barrier 1, 2, and 3 all in the same building, so that people can move from one location to the next location to the next, or not even move location, but move in programs and goals. We realize a true trauma-informed location for those levels 1 through 3 looks differently than a home, right? It's going to look a little different where we can have more people around you to talk to, more supports around you, your support groups in the building, such like that. And right now we're very careful of bringing people into the homes that aren't the residents in the home. But we also believe that in order to do that, there's a lot of support groups that you can go to, but you have to then go to those, or trainings on financial stability, right, that we don't bring into the homes. And so there's just a different way, a different model that we envision this to be even more effective and outcome-focused, and that's in one location, and that hasn't stopped. And then we do need space for support groups and meetings. We currently house NA, right, in our facility. And they, I don't know how many people they have on a daily basis.
Do you know how many people the NA group has?
I would say at least 25 every day.
Who come into our site, and it's a wonderful partnership too, because most of our clients are going there, and then we can involve with them every single day, so which is very nice. So this is our current opportunity that we're looking at, and one of the things that continues with the strategy that we created about 2.5 years ago, and we call it the Mid-Barrier Campus. We're using that word campus on purpose because it's not just a shelter. There's a lot of opportunity in this building. We have, for the last 3 years, looked at space since we moved out of 70 East Washington so that the low barrier shelter, which is operated by the City of Champaign Township, could go. We've been looking throughout the community for a space to do this. As I said earlier, we did propose that one be built in Urbana, and unfortunately that was not awarded, and that's, you know, there's a place for everything and a reason, so that's great. But we've looked at places that were like fraternity on campus, fraternity homes, apartment complexes, many things. We've all looked through a lot of buildings. We know a lot about Champaign. Our good friend Jill Guth, our broker, doesn't want to talk to us anymore. But she did find this space, and I think it came from Mike Royce saying, we should look at the old Christie Clinic Sleep Clinic, for those who know where that is. It's at 1207 South Mattis. It's a building it's about 12,000 square feet. The goal of the building right now, it houses actually a counseling program, which is kind of feels like it's our space, which we wouldn't change. So it would be counseling program with support groups in there already. It has a series of offices. And then it has what formerly the Christie Clinic Sleep Clinic. So I believe the building already has about 17 or 18 bathrooms, individual bathrooms. So you can see where I'm going, and I don't want to go through the whole building because I want to tell you what our need is. But it fits a lot of the marks, and it feels like it's the spot that we should be in. And so that's what we're looking at. We did one of the things, what we need to do, though, is to make the campus a reality is several things. One, the purchase price of this building is about $1.125. We've already secured $795, and I'll go through that in a second because there's wonderful partnerships behind us. We need about $330. We know the renovation costs are about $550. We've secured around $300, and we need $250 to do that. And then we've actually budgeted out for the next 5 years what we think it may cost, because one of the big things for us is sustainability. Our board is very committed that they're not going to agree to buy anything if we can't be sustainable. And I would agree with them. I think we all would. And so we've analyzed for the next 5 years of what it costs, And one of the things that CU at Home is highly committed on is being community-focused and community-funded. And so we raise about $600,000 a year, $600,000 to $750,000, and that will continue. We are committed to being community-focused with a community solution, as well as that helps us educate and advocate within the community for people, right? That's our goal, is that we're all one. But there's still a hole that we have, about $250,000 a year, to make this sustainable going forward. What we're excited, though, to present to you is what we already know. We have been working on this for many years. As I said, we did speak with the city of Urbana. Our drug court partnership with the judge has been very strong. We've also have been working with the Housing Authority of Champaign County for the last year and a half. We are written in their plan. So we are written in their 22, 23, 24 strategic plan. As you know, the Housing Authority is a return to work program, which means they have a little bit more control on how they use their resources locally. And they have written in their plan to continue to work in this mid-barrier space and to find a solution for the vacancies that we have. So we are working with them. We're written in their plan. They've committed to capital of about $600,000 in their plan. What we're pending on them, we talked to them this morning. We're still on that line. They're still working on ensuring that they can release it. And then we've asked them to consider the $300,000 more for renovations of that building, which they're on. So they talked to HUD this afternoon. We don't know the answer to that question, but they've talked to them several times. So we're pretty comfortable at the $900,000. Don't know when it'll get released, but that's what pretty comfortable. They're also committed, though, one of the wonderful things that we like with the Housing Authority is to give us their expertise. CU at Home, right, is a organization of 20 people, of which their admin team you see right here, right? And so we know what we need help with, and we know what partners in their community are best to give us. And so we are working with their director of project management. We actually have a meeting again with him on Friday to actually figure out what the renovations are, and he will help guide those renovations. We are also working with their team. We're very excited about is through the voucher programs. By partnering with the Housing Authority, our clients will get vouchers, which is an important part. Here again, you know, many of you may know more than I on this, but we're working through the details of them paying for operational funding for the organization in the future. May that look like a voucher, operating subsidy. They've committed to at least $150,000. So of the $250,000, that's the $150,000 they'll pay for that as well. All of that is great, and the money is great, but more importantly is we'll have a relationship with them to help us with guiding not only the facility itself, but helping our clients actually get to their own home, right? That's the most important part of that partnership to us. What we're asking for today is the same partnership with you. So there you go. We would love to partner on this. What we need here again is the fill in the void of the build, buy in the building. And so we're still asking for about $580,000 to buy the building and renovate it. We're asking for commitment on expertise and how to execute the program. We already have a wonderful program with drug court, and maybe that, and that'll definitely continue. But we realize that we only know what the greater good knows, so the more the merrier. And we'll continue to ask for the commitment from intensive case management. Here again, our friends at the Mental Health Board are, I hope, our advocates. They've always been our advocates, Lynn Canfield and Leon and such, but they have funded us for 2 years, so that's wonderful. And then one of the things that we are truly looking at is ongoing subsidies. And so I think that you may have heard from the judge, but one of the things that we asked him is how do we do that in a way? I don't know what that looks like. And I put Champaign County on here because I think there's many ways to do this, right? Whether it be this task force and or through the drug court or someplace else. But having the totality of Champaign County behind it as well is important. What we're going to bring to the table is several things. We actually have a DCEO grant from the former from Senator Bennett's office. Before he passed, we were earmarked a $300,000 capital grant. We used part of that money to buy the home that the women are at, that you're currently at. And then we have another $170,000 that we will use for this purpose. And we are here again, as I said, of our budget. Our budget's about 1.3 or 1.4 million. We raise somewhere between 650 and 700,000 of that in the community, and we'll continue to do that. So that's it.
Are there any questions from the task force?
Ms. Straub.
Hey, everybody. This is a great ask. It's really exciting. Obviously, the amount of time and passion that went into the planning for this is super impressive. And obviously, you got your two-year contract with the Mental Health Board, which is fantastic. I was super excited to guess that.
We jumped up and down.
Awesome, as you know, we all did. But mine was, you know, not actually jumping. It's hard at these desks. So obviously with the Mental Health Board, there are a lot of measures put into place to kind of see how your outreach is towards a diverse population. And, you know, in our work, I think we're all very aware that most of the spaces that we occupy when we're doing our work do not look like this room. How it's been more than a year since I've been in any of your spaces, which are lovely. How does that look right now as far as the people that you're serving, as far as your commitment to serving people in the future, as far as your leadership, as far as your board? What does diversity look like in your organization right now and in the people you serve?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. Sorry, am I? Yeah, so that's a great question. So I love the way you were talking about that too. It's not just in one area. It really has to be this layered system. And it is something that we've been very thoughtful about. And honestly, when I first came, we had to do some work around, and we're still needing to do that, to be completely transparent. So at the board level, for example, we've been very thoughtful about diversity. And I mean, I don't want to, if you want to speak on any of this, feel free.
You're
to
much more eloquent.
Okay. So but we've been very thoughtful about bringing people in at that board level who represent many different communities. So we're talking about racial diversity, sexual orientation, making sure we have diversity in that way. Somebody in recovery, you know, was very important to us to have on the board. And so we're looking at diversity in a lot of different categories and in a lot of different ways to make sure we have that representation. The same thing, you know, with our leadership and who we're bringing in, we're looking at diversity and representation on our staff so that, again, our clients see people that look like them on our staff and can identify with them. Same thing with clients. That's something that actually we talked with the judge about in terms of making sure that we are also receiving referrals, for example, from minority communities and underrepresented communities. So we are very thoughtful about that and want to continue to be. And I think, you know, as Tammy mentioned, we're open to learning and growing in areas that, you know, we may not have expertise in.
Yes.
Talk about Karen Sims.
So one of the things that we do to try to foster diversity is we do work with Karen Sims through the Learning Collaborative, not only kind of in the larger community, but also in one-on-one. So we're part of her Learning Collaborative where she's come in and she's done an organizational assessment for us, has looked at our policies and procedures, and is working through that process for us so that we can, again, make sure that we're always learning and growing.
Thank you.
Diane?
Yeah, mine's probably more a little bricks and mortar type thing. From a rural environment that I represent, sometimes it's very difficult to get into the community. So I wonder transportation, mm-hmm. because the bigger building, you would have people going in and out and in and out, not necessarily living there. And I don't want to discount because, quite frankly, up in our area, it's a pretty serious issue also. So diversity comes in many forms. So I just wonder about the transportation and how we get people in and out. I know we've really probably hit C carts pretty hard with this group, mm-hmm. trying to get some help with that. But I don't know anything about it. Is it on a major bus line? Is there a way to get in and out? Maybe that friend or that support person you're talking about. I just want to make sure that we do this for, you know, down in the Sydney area too, versus up in Ludlow and Rantoul.
Yes, so we do have one of our life skills staff members that is dedicated to transportation, because same, we see that the need is there. And so that person is full-time dedicated to transportation. And so what that means is, you know, scheduling rides, understanding where transportation needs are. You know, she keeps a pretty full calendar with that. But another part of that is also helping people understand the bus system, making sure that people have bus passes. Also working with MCOs, for example, to make sure that people have appropriate transportation to medical appointments, because a lot of people don't know or realize that MCOs will provide those kinds of transportation. So the transportation program for us is fairly new. We've started that this fiscal year. So we are still developing it out, but we do have a person dedicated to transportation.
Melissa?
Yes.
So one of the things that I personally, I'm sorry.
All right. Thank you.
So one of the things I'm personally excited about is the location of the Mattis property is within very close walking distance of Carl Addiction Recovery. And so that that could not have been a more ideal location, because a lot of what people with opioid addictions and really alcohol addictions are going to need is some medically assisted therapy as well, in addition to IOP services. So I just want to say, at CU at Home, we're very supportive of all the tools that a person in recovery needs, things like medically assisted therapy, 12-step involvement, IOP, and really just case management services in general. So that's why it speaks to that transportation issue of this for us seems to be almost an ideal location because of its close proximity to Carl Addiction Recovery.
So, Dr. Storr and then Jen again.
I did. You said something about medical appointments and. Did I get NCO or something? What is that?
An MCO is a person's managed care organization, so it's basically their insurance provider. Most of our clients have either Molina or Meridian, and they will provide transportation to clients. Sometimes it is a little difficult. They show up most of the time, but we do have some times where they don't show up. Yeah, Jen's shaking her head. But so we do, again, have that transportation person also in place. But we want people, ideally, again, when they move into their own home and are integrated into the community, they know what resources they can access beyond CU at Home. And so, again, they feel stable in their own environment.
And for me, and, you know, the thousands of people watching this at home. what is an IOP?
You can explain that one.
It's intensive outpatient treatment. It's 9 or more hours of treatment services per week.
Thank you.
And we actually have good relationships with both the providers in town, Rosecrans and Carl Addiction Services. We've had clients in both treatment facilities.
That's amazing. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to also take a minute to touch back with the idea of folks graduating out with a voucher. And you know, I spent most of the shutdown emailing Cedar like every single day trying to get people vouchers, trying to track people down to get them vouchers. And so the idea that people can, you know, finish and just have this thing, this golden ticket kind of thing is... it's a big deal.
Aaron?
Can I speak to that issue? So one of the things quite often we get, sometimes people will come into our program street homeless, and one of the things that they talk about is the ongoing trauma of being street homeless kind of increases their motivation to use drugs and alcohol. And so one of the things that we feel strongly about is that if people can get into a safe environment, the motivation for using drugs and alcohol is going to be lessened just by simply that alone. So the whole possibility of obtaining a voucher by working the CU at home program as well as their own recovery program, that's pretty powerful for long-term recovery.
Now Aaron.
Thanks. Couple questions. I guess first one's, I believe I know the answer, but I just want to make sure in my mind, the 25 that you're talking about, if you were to move into this building, would be on top of the existing two houses. You would keep those in operation as well?
So what we would do with those two houses, they would stay in our inventory, but they would become phase four houses. Okay. So basically what would happen there, so they're eight-person homes but with four bedrooms. So what would happen there, they would become four and four.
Okay.
So each person would get their own bedroom. For example, you know, our men's house is slightly bigger than our women's house, but eight women in this house is a lot. It's a lot on the plumbing. It's a lot just in terms of people needing to de-escalate, needing their own space. And so that's what we would do. But they would remain in our inventory.
Okay, thanks. And then the second question, I guess, has to do with your ask. From my standpoint, the initial ask of the $580,000, just from the standpoint of that's a one-time ask, being one time in that respect, that's an easy ask. I mean, it's up to us whether to say yes or no. It's the ongoing 100,000, and not saying it's not a reasonable ask, it's not for an excellent program, but in part there's just the whole thing of, you know, future boards, whether or not they would agree that this is the best use of the money and future budgets. And everything, trying to meet budgets and spend our money wisely. Just the idea, let's say that we're out on the 100,000 per year. We're just out. Mm-hmm. Do you see that being an issue as to keeping this going? I mean, do you believe you could still get enough input, enough income, you know, grants and whatever else to keep this going should we say yes on, say, the $580,000?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question because I think as Tammy was talking about, sustainability is so important to us. And I think that's one of the reasons, again, she kind of, you know, included Champaign County. I mean, obviously, like, if you say yes to the $100,000, again, we'll be doing that same dance we were doing for the mental health board, you know. But we understand that, you know, this may need to come from several different resources. And so, for example, one of the things that we've talked with the judge about is maybe some funding that even could channel through drug court as we help drug court-specific clients. So there's, you know, a way that some funding could come through drug court. But we would definitely continue to pursue grants to continue to pursue funding. So, yeah.
Melissa, could I say something on
Yes,
that?
Please.
Mr. Morris, this is being recorded. Can you just wait to talk until you're at the mic? Thank you. We need people at home to be able to hear. Thank
sure.
you.
Sure. So about 10 years ago when I got asked to get on the CU at Home board, and we didn't have any housing and there wasn't a shelter, you know, I started to get familiar with the system that takes care of the homeless. And it really has improved a lot. All the collaborations and conversations have started to get to where we're not going to get rid of homeless, but we're starting to help people have some hope in getting out of it, and we're trying to get good at it. We're nowhere close to done. I would say to your question, though, just pre-COVID, we were 100% community funded, just whatever we get from churches. We then went through COVID and got some governmental funding. But when we upped our game to start hiring professionals, Melissa's a godsend, and start focusing on outcomes to get people permanently off the street, we started to do a better job. We're starting to get, you know, some funding commitments. Mental Health Board gave us 2 years. Well, it was 1 year, you know, so we're scrappy. And we're also working to build the system. And then the final thing I'll say is putting a tri-agency partnership with a firm that knows how also to go raise funding in the community, we think gives us that broader chance of good long-term funding stability that we're after. So it's okay is my answer to you.
Emily?
We've answered this in a couple ways, but are you seeking out any additional partnerships for this money, particularly from other bodies of government?
So our primary partner, are you talking about for the purchase of the facility, is the Housing Authority. They're really our primary partner. And again, we're written in the Move to Work plan. We have the $750 that's guaranteed through that plan. But they're willing to go back to HUD and ask for more money, which was the conversation that they were going to have today to assist us with the purchase and renovations of the building, and then coming to you all today. So that's kind of in terms of the capital portion of that.
Okay, it's my turn. I really liked hearing about the proximity to Carl's substance abuse treatment, because we really, I think, as a body, we've heard over and over from multiple agencies about medically assisted treatment being what we need. And in conversations I've had with Rosecrans, I know that they're now going to be able to provide it once they can find someone to do the prescribing, but that's still there. In terms of when you spoke earlier, you said that there's a screening for what people might need. So when somebody comes in for a screening to participate, and they're not a drug court client, but they're still someone, and maybe they're already on medically assisted treatment, that's not going to preclude them coming in because they've got this medical need or anything.
No, absolutely not. We have people already in our program that are on medically assisted treatment. So one of the things that we ask and really require is that the medication, if they're take-homes, are locked in a safe. And that's just because, obviously, we don't want misuse, and the street value of the drugs could be a concern. And so we don't pass meds. We're not a nursing facility in that way, so it is the client's responsibility to come and say, it's time for my medication, but those things stay locked in a safe. Okay. But it doesn't in any way mean that someone cannot come into our program.
Okay. And then I guess another sort of an ask that I have, like if we were to contribute, it seems like you said that Rosecrans, you have a partnership with them, and so their people can kind of not cut the line, but be aware of what the line is. And with the partnership with drug court. But we don't want people to have to become court involved to seek help, right? And so is there a way that we could set up a line awareness for county residents also who just, are in need, they're opioid dependent or have suffered in some way with due to opioids, so that this money could go towards that. If we were to contribute, could we basically dedicate, like there can always be, some level of priority for Champaign County opioid dependent persons?
Yeah, I definitely think that's something that we could work on. I think right now, again, part of what the 25-person bed capacity allows us to do is think a little bit differently about how we can use those beds. So, drug court, Rosecrans, Cunningham Township, when we get referrals from our partner organizations, we do prioritize those. But with the 25-person capacity, again, we could look a little bit differently about how we can set beds aside and what that could look like for sure.
Any other questions?
So
I see Michelle.
So can I just add some to that? So one of the things, I've been doing addiction treatment for years, and one of the things I've become a firm believer in medically assisted therapy, and I've seen it save lives. So really with anybody who's opioid dependent or even alcohol dependent, we are at the place where we strongly encourage medically assisted therapy, because we have just seen so even if they do go to 12-step meetings, even if they do complete IOP, the chance their outcomes are so much better if they're able to get access to medically assisted therapy. And so it's just something that's, you know, we've learned that it's so critically important for our clients. So,
Michelle, did you want to add to what I said?
I was just going to say that in terms of the $100,000 per year concern, there's other ways that the county contributes to that. So we've got the adult redeployment grant, and our goal is every year to start significantly increasing what we're asking for with the idea of being able to expand the capacity of drug court. And a big piece of that budget is just housing. And Judge Dyer's made it clear that his preferred choice is that the participants go to see you at home. So essentially that money would funnel from the state through drug court, you know, towards see you at home in terms of that piece. So I think that, you know, Aaron's obviously correctly right. We can't commit future boards to something, but there's other ways that the county can contribute to that cost.
Ms. Michaels?
I got a couple things. If I can couple in on that, it just brought something to my brain too, is that I know that we have a one-time amount, but then there's also an annual amount that we will receive for, what is it, 10 years?
I think. Oh, no, 2039.
Oh, excuse me. More than that, 15 years. And not that we would maybe appropriate the full amount, but maybe a portion of that could go towards this annual request. And then back to the program, because I'm really not very familiar other than what I've read and seen or heard in the community. How long does it take? When is the turnover that you have more beds available? I mean, there's got to be a certain time limit where this person's here for, you know, 6-8 weeks or maybe 6 months and then whatever, because that also falls into play with getting other people in there. So I don't know what the turnover is. I know you want them to go through phase 1 through 3, ultimately through 4. And so I didn't know how quick or how long that generally takes.
So I think our program in general, we say, is about 12 to 18 months, and that kind of encompasses all of the phases. Obviously, it does depend on the way each client progresses through the phase system. I think phase 1 through 3, would you say maybe 9 months for the whole?
Yeah, so we kind of designed it to be about approximately 9 months. And I don't know, we're kind of thinking on our feet here at the moment. So I think we're thinking 9 months for phases 1 through 3 and then maybe another 9 months for phase 4. And the idea is as long as a person is making reasonable progress and has a reasonable amount of motivation, then we'll give them extensions for the program. Because one of the, for a person maybe who hasn't worked in 10 years or maybe they haven't worked ever, so starting off at an entry-level position and then working up into some type of income that could be self-sustaining for them, that might take longer than 18 months to do that. And so, and then sometimes we've had also clients that maybe have excessive amounts of debt or excessive amounts of court fines that they need to pay. And so those are other financial obstacles to becoming housed at times.
Follow up to that is there an end? I mean, is there a time where you say this is working or this isn't working? And then I understand that it takes time, and I understand different people progress at different stages in their life depending on what the beginning was and how they want to change that. But somewhere along the line, there's got to be, okay, we've done this, and now we need to let you fly.
Yes, so every 90 days, participants go through a program review. And so we look at, are they attending case management meetings? Are they attending their recovery meetings? Are they meeting their financial goals? And then, you know, kind of the determination at that point is, are they ready to phase up? Or, and again, we have had to do this where we say, you know, there's this program may not be for you. And again, we don't do that right away at the end of the first 90 days. There's opportunity to address, look at barriers, continue to try to move forward. But there are times where we do have to discharge people from the program. It hasn't happened very often, which is very, very good. But I think the other part of that question maybe is too, like, as people are getting closer to the end of the year, you know, again, there's a lot of emphasis on what do you have left to do. If you request an extension, it's only an extension for 6 months. So we're very thoughtful about trying to continue to move people forward. We don't want people to kind of get so comfortable that they're no longer moving forward in the program. And, you know, that does happen sometimes. We have to push people a little, partly because a lot of times for people we're the first place they've ever felt safe, first place they've ever felt community. A lot of women in our house right now are trying to figure out how to form some sort of like compound somewhere, you know, because they're there, they're comfortable, they're safe, they're supported. So the other thing that we do with that is we have an extended care program. And so when someone is discharged from our program, if they choose to, we will case manage them in their own place for an additional 6 to 9 months. And most of our clients take us up on that. They want that support even after they've moved.
Melissa, could I say something?
Sure.
So to the Champaign County preference issue, our preference is to serve Champaign County. And I wanted you to understand that when we're prioritizing people, it's based on who we think can be more successful. When Cedar was talking about people that are already having services, they have a greater likelihood. But we also work with all the other homeless providers collaboratively. Some of our clients go back to Strides, and we cry about that, you know. And if they can come around again, you know, it's not over. So it's never over. We never give up on them. We're not wanting to become the center of homelessness for the United States of America either. You know, it's about putting outcomes first for these people.
Chris?
So can I add just a little bit to that? So one of the benefits to our partnership with Drug Court is we've kind of modeled our newest program based upon Drug Court. And one of the things that Drug Court has done extraordinarily well is they've have very specific objective standards that people who are sentenced to Drug Court have to meet. And so years ago, back in 2009, I was on the Drug Court team, and that was a constant source of frustration for people because they didn't know exactly what they needed to do in order to be successful in Drug Court. Well, all that has completely changed. And one of the things I really have to credit Melissa on is that she's taken this idea of having a very objective standard of what we expect from our clients and what Drug Court expects from their from people sentenced to Drug Court and kind of applied it to our program. And one of the things, I was kind of a hard sell on this, but one of the things I've seen is the clients get excited and are more motivated when they know they have a very specific, attainable standard for them to meet. And I've actually seen several of our clients actually pick up their motivation for that reason. Oh, this is what I need to do. Okay, I'll do that specifically. And I think that's... we're seeing some differences in motivation with a number of our clients because of that. So,
thank you. Mr. Rice, thanks for your elaboration about, you know, prioritizing, you know, likelihood to succeed and also, you know, the relapse, complete relapse, and started the whole thing over again. And how frequently does that happen, do you think?
I've been to Carl emergency room several times in the last year.
Sure.
I would say it happens ironically more frequently with our alcohol dependent clients than it seems to be any other drug. And that's one of the reasons why I've become sold on medically assisted therapy for alcohol dependent clients as well, too. So the with our opioid our clients who are receiving medically assisted therapy already, the relapse rate is actually very low. And so that's one of the things we're very pleased about.
Yeah, and I would say kind of to your question about like how many times you have to have somebody go all the way back to the beginning, I would say that's really only happened once, where mm-hmm. we had somebody who had several relapses in a row, relapse incidents in a row. And that's to the point where, again, we're going to the emergency room. But generally speaking, when we see a relapse, we're able to look at the plan, and the person generally, again, doesn't have to go all the way back to treatment. We're looking, again, at meetings. Have they fallen off in contact with their sponsor? Is their sponsor the right person? Do they need intensive outpatient or aftercare? So we really try to assess the whole program. And, thankfully, I think only one person has had to really go from that phase four back to, well, you really need to start over.
Okay. So I think in general, there's it's the idea that addiction is a disease. And I know traditionally in sober living programs, if a person relapsed, they were basically put out on the streets, which is just about the worst thing that can happen to somebody who's relapsed. And so the idea is if a person is suffering from a disease, we're going to help them get treatment for that disease. And so we will work with people as long as they're willing. We will work with people to address those needs when they do relapse.
Aaron?
Another quick question. Back to the ask again. This is kind of out there, but yet then again. So from the aspect of purchasing this particular property, on that particular property, is there anything that you're aware of that like makes this super urgent? I mean, not that I don't believe anyone on this committee would want to drag this decision out, you know, over 3 or 4 months, but things can tend to kind of turn slow. Is there anything that, like, I don't know, like, say, coming up, you know, at the end of this month, the owner's getting tired of sitting on it and he's going to send it to public auction or something like that? I mean, that probably wouldn't happen, but is there anything funny that would make this something, because as a committee, we're just going to, you know, give our advice to the full county board, you could say, and then the full county board votes on it. So is there anything from a county-wise and also maybe from Michelle Jett's side of once the county board makes that decision, you know, should we advance something that Michelle would need to be aware of to, you know, try and get the agreement or whatever, all the paperwork, you could say, done correctly?
2 weeks ago, I would have answered, no, I think we're okay. And then the owner called and said, I got to lease the building out to all the people that want to put leases in it if you don't give us an offer and start the process. So we went ahead and negotiated a price, and I think today we're signing a contract starting a 60-day due diligence period. We have permission for one 90-day extension, so we one 30-day extension to a total of 90 days, and we don't know what will happen to this facility. We have been looking at other facilities for a while. This one is the only one that I'm aware of in this community that doesn't have particular issues. We're going to have to get a zoning special use permit, which the City of Champaign staff is recommending. They think it's fantastic. We think it's fantastic. It's a bit of a miracle, so that's a bit of a problem. We can build a facility somewhere else, but, you know, it's a really unusual circumstance, and yes, sir, we're in a real big hurry. Now, we could, you know, if we get pretty sure that maybe we can, you know, get an extension, I don't know, but we're counting on you to pay some attention to us.
Michelle, did you want to speak to Aaron's question at all before we continue?
I just think from a timeline perspective, if you guys felt comfortable making a recommendation to the board this month, you could do that at the August board meeting, and then we could prepare. We'll need to do a budget amendment because we don't have any of this money appropriated, and we could get that done in September, which would also give us time to get the contract together because we need to iron out those details. So I think from their perspective, if you were interested, we could get it in within the timeline of what they're talking about.
Jen, did I see your hand first?
Is Christy the owner of the property right now?
No.
Oh, okay.
Dr. Storr, did you have a question? It is long and luxurious, so you should. Well, you've given us a lot to talk about. If you want to hang out and watch us do that. But thank you very much for your presentation and for the very good work that that you've been doing and that the judge speaks so highly of and the community speaks so highly of. So thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having us and letting us do this presentation. And obviously, if there are other questions that after we leave arise, please feel free to reach out. So.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right, moving on to our next steps discussion. We had our first real ask today. I guess we need to talk about it.
No problem. We know.
Do we have other asks lined up?
At this point, not yet. There's some discussions about how we could potentially help fund medically assisted treatment, but there's none of that yet.
Technology. Okay, after 45, it just buttons are hard. My understanding of kind of the landscape right now, and maybe I'm wrong, please correct me if I am, is that we could earmark money for medically assisted treatment, and we, I think, all have heard really convincing arguments to do that, but with the dearth of providers in our area, that's just money sitting in our bank account right now.
Yes, yeah. And speaking with Rosecrans, they've been identified as a pilot program for, I forget the whole long acronym, but basically they have to start providing medically assisted treatment, but they have to find someone to do it. And it doesn't have to be a doctor now. It can be some other medical providers, but again, they need to find someone to do it. And so at some point there may be requests for how we can help fund that in an ongoing sort of incentive, like a retainage bonus for every month you're still here, the county kicks in. Who knows? Who knows how that will go? But that is at this point not an ask on the table, and we don't want to let perfection be the enemy of the good, and we have an ask that was recommended by the drug court judge. Mm-hmm. And Aaron.
So as to this particular ask that we had tonight, I don't know if you, Chair Locke, or this might be a Ms. Jett question, remind us again how much right now we have in the account, if you would please.
Drum roll. We have just shy of $1 million in the account, but we also are continuing to get notifications of new settlements. And I think I need to go back and double check on the yearly amount that we'll be getting, and I can email you all an update on that as well. But we've got a good chunk of money, so yeah.
Real quick, then I guess. Granted, this is the first ask we've had, but again, as Ms. Locke just said, you know, the judge is saying this is a good deal and everything. I would, personally, I guess, I'd be open to putting forward to the full county board to approve the ask for the $580,000.
Yeah.
it's doing absolutely no good other than maybe drawing some interest, but whoop-dee, sitting in the bank account. If this can do some good, let's get it out there and start doing something with it. So I don't know if we need that as a motion by me. I can make that a motion to go ahead and approve the $580,000 for both the purchase and the renovation costs, if so be it.
I believe right now it would just be a straw poll for us to push it forward to the county board. And so if everybody show a hand, yeah, it appears to be unanimous that we all support going forward. Ms. Straub.
I definitely like to hear what the rest of the board says. I think it's a big chunk of money, and you know, this gives also some room for public comment if people feel strongly about it, which we obviously want to hear. But I just want to take another brief minute to talk about my work, because that's what I do. The low barrier shelter is full. It's full. People are coming into my office every day talking about how there's just not a safe place to sleep. People are calling the police on folks who just have tents in, you know, wooded areas of town, not bothering anybody because they don't want homeless people sleeping there. The community, and that would be considering the whole county, really, because folks come here a lot of times if they become homeless in Rantoul or other places, mm-hmm. because we have the resources, right? We're hurting right now. People are really hurting. And if we can add 25 beds, even though those are specialty beds for people who are dealing with substance use disorders, that offloads some of the other resources available. And whew, that sounds really good to me.
Diane?
I'm going to parrot some of this, actually. This is an easy one. I know I missed the meeting where Rose Kranz made the presentation, but I read the minutes, and they seem very vague and not very specific on things that we felt years ago, some of us been on the board that long, that should have already been in place and already handled. I like that this couples in with our court system. I think it's up to each one of us to go back to our friends that are on the board and talk to them about this, but definitely have it on the next board meeting for the 580. And the other part is, before I think it was like 90,000. Of course, it'll be more than that every year with this.
So, it kind of bounces around a bit. 90 is like if we averaged it out.
Right.
And I will actually go check on that spreadsheet again now that we've had these new settlements come through and see if that's adjusted at all.
So even if we down the road, not to begin with, but down the road after this first part gets sent out, that we say, okay, let's put 25 towards their annual. It would be something that would also sustain this for us and for our court systems and for the community. I really like how they've got everything together.
Ed?
I'll agree with that. I think it's a big ask, but we have a fairly good amount in there. It's not like it's taking all the money away that we could provide somebody else who came in with an ask. And let's face it, they have it together and they're ready. So I think this is an easy one. Yeah.
All right. So it seems like we're all in agreement. So we'll put that forward and we'll talk to our seatmates and our friends on the board to push this forward and hopefully get it approved. Michelle?
So I just want to confirm what process you want to take. So do you want me to put together the budget amendment and we put that on the county board agenda, not the COW, but the county board agenda, and have the conversation around the vote around the budget amendment? Or do you just want to have the conversation and then we do the budget amendment in September?
I mean, it seems like time is of the essence for them. And we have heard all of this and we're all aboard. And the money that would be allocated belongs specifically to the settlement fund. So we're not asking the board to spend general fund money. So,
correct.
So is everybody in agreement to just put the amendment to the board budget amendment? Yeah, that's great.
So we'll go straight to the amendment at the full board. It won't be on the consent agenda. We'll let CU at Home know. I think it would be good for them to be here again. And we'll also let Judge Dwyer know in case he wants to attend as well. Okay, all right.
Should this be, when you say go to the full board, would we see this at the COW? Are you envisioning? I'm just asking.
I don't think so, because it would be in finance and they'd be like, what is this? Why didn't you tell us about this? And I don't want to get yelled at for like not having told them that they were going to have like $600,000 budget amendment that they're surprised by. So that's why I'd like to just skip to the whole county board.
That's fine. I was just wanting to clarify own.
Dr. Storer.
Along that line, because we don't want to surprise our colleagues, you know, later in the month, could we have a discussion point or an opioid settlement task force report that might kind of give them a heads up that something's coming?
How about we include this in the county board agenda packet, and I can type up a quick, here's how much we have, how much we're expecting, so they can see the numbers, I think that's a good point. They're not nearly as informed as you all are.
Not everybody likes surprises as much as we did when we were 8 years old.
And Jen Locke, maybe you have to specify your last name. Maybe say something during public communications, something like that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can I say, too, that an action plan will come from this committee? Even though you guys didn't take a formal vote, I will make an action plan that would be in the county board agenda, just like facilities and ELUC and those other committees.
Well, now moving on, date of next meeting. Are there any asks coming down the pike at this point that we know of, Ms. Jett?
I think Kate's been trying to communicate with Rosecrans again. You know, they were very honest with us that the issue to them not having the medical personnel to do the prescription of the medically assisted treatment is money. And we said money's what we have. So, you know, try to get somebody on the hook and figure out what you could need so we can start talking about what that's going to look like. But we're waiting for that next step to be able to come back to you and talk about what actual numbers would possibly be. So,
individual members, has anybody in the community reached out to us? Nobody's reached out to me and said, hey, we've got this. Once upon a time, Street Outreach Ministries did float an idea, but then Mr. Charter moved. So there's nothing coming. He did. So I've received nothing. Has anybody in the community reached out or anything? Okay. We continue to look for ways to spend this money. We want to. Aaron?
Just quick question. I don't believe anybody does, or they probably have already brought it up, because I don't. But kind of back to the next step discussion. Does anybody else have any, you know, updates on any of the other topics that we've discussed before? I mean, I like I say, I believe it would have been brought up already, but I just wanted to double check, and it doesn't appear. So that's all. Thank you.
Thank you for keeping us honest. All right, so date of next meeting, we don't want to meet just to meet. We should meet when there's an ask. We also shouldn't wait 6 months for another meeting. I know that we have a meeting, Michelle, with Rosecrans again at the end of August, but we should maybe get through the budget and plan to meet sometime in September, October.
Yeah, let's at least do the August meeting and make sure she actually has more information for us before we schedule something of your all's time. And once we have those numbers from her, then we could have another meeting and that could be our next conversation.
Okay. All right. I have no chair's report, and I call this meeting adjourned at 7:50 p.m. Thank you for coming.